the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at midnight. This is Anna Cunningham. Anthony Joshua has been knocked out in the fifth round of his world heavyweight title fight against Daniel Dubois at Wembley Stadium. Joshua had hoped to become the IBF belt holder for a third time, but Dubois dominated the fight after knocking him down in round one. Here's the moment it was all over.
And another right hand from Joshua, and a huge right uppercut, but during the course of an exchange, a blistering right hand has deposited Anthony Joshua on the canvas. A towel has come in from Ben Davison, and this contest is over.
Dozens of Israeli warplanes have been carrying out widespread attacks on Hezbollah targets in southern Lebanon as the two sides continue to exchange fire across the border. Earlier, Lebanon's health ministry said 37 people had died in an Israeli airstrike on a block of flats in Beirut yesterday. From the city, our senior international correspondent, Ola Guerin, gave this update.
Tonight, Israel has been stepping up its bombardment of southern Lebanon. Now, it says it is doing that in response to intelligence it had that Hezbollah was planning to carry out a series of attacks on Israel. It says dozens of warplanes are involved, some of the heaviest bombardment that we have seen in this year-long conflict.
Lawyers representing women who say they were sexually assaulted by the former Harrods owner Mohammed Al-Fayed say they've received more than 150 new inquiries since a BBC documentary revealed allegations against him. Mr. Al-Fayed owned the store for 25 years. He died in 2023. The current owners say they're appalled and have urged women to get in touch with them to seek a settlement. Donald Trump has said he will not take part in another televised debate with Kamala Harris before the presidential election. The vice president has accepted an invitation from CNN to hold a second debate. Brian Anderson is a political journalist in North Carolina, where Mr. Trump is currently campaigning.
It's worth noting, Trump says it's too late to debate, but if you remember back in 2016 and 2020, those debates were actually scheduled for later than September 21st. So he's accepted debates universally in 2016 and in 2020 at later times than we're in right now.
Elon Musk has backed down in his legal fight with a Brazilian judge who closed down his social media platform X in the country. The New York Times says the company will block the accounts of about 300 users accused of spreading disinformation and far-right views. It's also appointed a legal representative and has promised to reopen its office in the country. The weather: southern England and Wales will see heavy spells of showery rain with a chance of thunder, dry elsewhere. That's the latest BBC News at 3 minutes. It's past midnight.
BBC Radio 5 Live. The home of Formula One.
Oscar Piastri wins the Azerbaijan Grand Prix. He takes his second Formula One win in the last five races.
Exciting times in F1.
This Sunday from 1.
Marina Bay Street Circuit.
Singapore.
Can Red Bull turn around their fortunes on a track that they haven't got good history at? Or are McLaren in a league of their own now?
Listen to live coverage of every lap
on 5 Sports Extra and BBC Sounds.
Now on 5 Live, Sports Strangest Crimes, Confessions of a Match Fixer.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
The following podcast contains some strong language.
You're at a match, it's coming to kick off. No one knows what the final score is going to be. Or maybe some people do. See that number 4? Look how he keeps pushing forward, leaving space in behind. And the goalie, he's coming off his line way too much. To me, these are signs that something's going on with this match. That maybe some of these players aren't playing to win, they're playing to lose. See that guy in the crowd with the red cap? See how those players keep looking at him? It could be that he's paying them to throw this game, and he's here to make sure they do what they're told. I know what I'm talking about. I've not just seen it all before. I've done it all before. I've played in games that were fixed, and I've fixed games too. I've even done time because of it. My name is Moses Swebu, and I was a match fixer.
A match
match-fixing investigator has highlighted two matches that he says appear to have suspicious betting patterns.
From Finland to Zimbabwe, Korea to Turkey, football players, coaches and officials have either admitted or been found guilty of fixing games.
Among those arrested are several football players.
Oh boy, match-fixing is the scourge of the game, and it's also sort of the dirty secret.
I went from a promising youth player to working with some pretty dangerous people. I got in deep not realising how dangerous this world could be.
There was one club in the top level of the conference. Their chairman was threatened and his car was set light to on the front of his house. And then you're starting to think, this isn't just a few players getting together to fix games. This is very serious.
Thing is, it was only when I was in prison that I realised what I'd done.
This is the shocking moment English football has been dreading. In a Manchester hotel, an undercover reporter is being told by a man with alleged links to Asian betting syndicates that he can bribe players to fix matches.
Now I'm telling my story to a player I respect.
I think you do love football, but I don't think you love football.
I'm going back to my past to face some of those I let down.
Thing is, I know what your answer's going to be, but I have to ask it because the fans need me to ask this question.
Along the way, I'll tell you exactly how a match is fixed and why some of the smallest matches are worth millions to betting syndicates on the other side of the world.
Match fixing, boy, it's rampant throughout the game.
This is Confessions of a Match Fixer. Episode 1, Sleep with the Money. I'm going to tell my story to Premier League footballer Troy Deeney.
While Troy was making his way up the leagues, ending up in a Premier League, my career started at Crystal Palace, then down the leagues, ending up in a Conference South at Bromley.
We both had a tough life. We both had football as our way out. I chose to work hard and try to keep my head down. This is a story of sliding doors and the dark side of our beautiful game. I've just realised we've been recorded. Everyone good? You ready?
Yeah, ready.
First question. How honest are you going to be with me?
Don't hold back. As honest. As
no,
honest
not as me. How honest are you going to be?
Yeah, this is 100%.
Okay.
Yeah.
100%.
Yeah, 100%.
So, I think it's important to understand how you got into football.
So, I remember my house was one of the first households that had a TV. We'd watch Match of the Day, Arsenal fan, and that's what really kind of inspired me to like
get
into football.
Righty,
yeah, Ian Wright, 100%.
Yeah,
Ian Wright. So obviously with him being black and scoring goals,
yep.
He was unorthodox.
Mm-hmm.
And I think at that time he was just doing things different. I think when you're so young and you're looking up to idols or role models,
mm-hmm.
He's scoring goals, he's stamping on Peter Schmeichel. And then at home I had my big brother. He's like 2 years older than me. He played for a team called Croydon Athletic. I just remember watching him and his friends, but they never used to let me play football. And it was like, you're never going to be better than me. And I remember like him saying that, I just felt something.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't even anger. I just felt something in my chest. I'm like, nah. I said to myself, how can you make me feel like that?
Yeah.
You know what, let me just go outside and start playing football. So I joined their junior teams.
So I can think back, like, certain teachers, there's certain coaches that got me into, I think what got me to here today, if I'm being totally honest with you. Was there anyone like that that moved it for you?
Our manager at the time was a guy called Andy.
Brogan.
Andy Brogan, yeah. Andy was like, how do I describe him? Andy just had a big heart. That's what I remember being a kid. And I remember he got me and all of my friends together and was like, yeah, we're going to start a football team. Like, when Andy was around, you just knew, like, no matter what's going on, who's been naughty at home, who can't come out, if Andy's around, everybody trusts him.
Mm.
I remember just being in that team, it just made me feel at home.
Yeah.
No matter where you're coming from.
And I said, yeah, we're going to start a football team. Do you fancy playing? And you were so quiet and shy.
Yeah.
But you said yes. And that's how I first met you.
Mm.
You weren't the best of trainers, but he was undroppable for games. He was really, you're really quick, you're athletic, yeah. You like football. From a young age, a lot of our, you know, our parents, we would say, this lad's going to make it, surely. Because you could, from a young age, you could read the game. You was so crucial as part of that team.
And I remember I used to hate when I wasn't captain. I think you managed to get the best out of me because I knew when it comes to a game, I have to give 100%.
Yeah.
I remember being so young, and when I came into the team, everyone's my friend. We had a tight-knit group with all the boys.
Yeah.
And part of that group was looking out for each other, going into school, making sure we're doing the right things. We just had each other's backs.
And we had the structure there outside of the football, all meeting at my house on a Sunday morning, having breakfast, having toast, having cups of tea, causing carnage, and just built everyone's sort of like that unity. And obviously the successes that we did have as a football team was part and parcel of that structure that we had just... We didn't even know we was doing that. And I'm not going to sit here and say, yeah, that was all a plan, because it wasn't the plan.
Mm.
It's just the way it was. It was the perfect storm.
I always felt that park and your home was a safe haven.
Your dad was there for the first couple of years. When it, all of a sudden he stopped coming, then I just put two and two together and I realised that things had changed. I never questioned you on it. It wasn't my place to. I didn't think it was anyway. But what I did know is that you, as well as everyone else, once you was under my authority, you were going to be safe. I was going to look after you come what may.
So, with my dad, he was like, obviously, he's a Ugandan refugee. I remember, like, obviously, being young. Just love, man.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I think when you're young, you don't really know what struggle is.
Absolutely.
It's almost like earlier on in your life, you don't know about problems or what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, when you're young, you just, I'm a boy, he's a man. And it's like, he was my role model before anyone. So, background, parents are both Ugandan. I was born here. My mum and dad, they're very strict and disciplinary. You know, we had to go to school, we had to do our homework, we had to go and pray 5 times a day and learn the Quran. But then my parents split up. My brother and I went and moved with my dad to Croydon. So he had moved away from the family home and we made our life there.
Where are we heading, was this?
We are heading to my second house that I lived in Croydon. These are probably the closest things in South Croydon you can get to a council estate. And I haven't been here since I was probably 12 years old. My house was literally in that top corner on the left. Yeah, I was going through a stage in my life where I never really had the best relationships with my dad. My school finished around 3 o'clock. And the first thing he said to me was, Moses, look, if you're not home by 4:30, the door's locked. I didn't know what that means. I got home at like 5 minutes past, and this was what, in the afternoon, and the door was locked. That door did not open until 9 a.m. the next morning. So by the time I get home, I know I'm going to be locked out anyway. So a lot of my time was actually spent on the bus all the way to Coulson. Probably like a half an hour journey there and back. And I remember sitting at the back of the bus, falling asleep, waking up, trying to hide so the bus driver doesn't see me. And I just ride night buses. But I was very much like someone that's a deep thinker.
Mm-hmm.
And the deeper I thought when I'm traveling all across London, I'm cutting through so many different areas, north, east, south, and west, seeing how people behave and move.
You got all of this going on at home. And the only reason I can relate to this is I was in my community knowing who does what they do, how to do this, how to do that. When you come from an environment in which we've come from, you learn to watch people quickly. Mm. You learn to understand, okay, he does that, these are his traits.
And when you go past 7 o'clock, now you're the only one left, that's when reality keeps in, because the bus driver looks up and it's like, you got to get off the next stop. But I can't go down and say, I'm homeless or I'm locked out.
So this is the mesh. So if you look through that door, so I used to sleep on that step and sleep like in a stairwell. So the neighbour will pop his head round and be like, oh, come in. And I just go and I'll be like, yeah, I've been locked out again. Can I stay on the sofa? And they'll just say, yeah, come in.
Saying there, like, that your neighbour?
Yeah, the neighbour. Yeah. Obviously, one of the times we've gone into the house, slept on a mattress, and I'm like, you can't sleep if it ain't your bed.
Yeah.
I start seeing stuff, and I'm like, so loads of needles and everything on the floor, and I'm like, you have to remember, you're probably like 12, 13,
mm-hmm.
but you've never been exposed to things like that, so you don't know what they are.
Yeah.
And like, that was probably the biggest turning point in where, like, I got quite cold, if I say that. All I ever wanted to do was go to school, be happy and be free. And it wasn't until I left that room and I left this house when I was really free and I was able to kind of live out what my dreams were. When I went into football, you can't take drugs, you can't smoke, you can't take alcohol.
So I'm in Andy's team and we're playing a county game. I think I'm around about 15 at the time. I get a call. Moses, you know Crystal Palace have been looking at you.
Someone had let them know that you were good.
I was invited by my school to go to a trial game. And obviously at the trial game, it was the first local recruitment that the club had put on. I've gone there and I remember I was actually playing centre-back with a striker. And he was my good friend from the area. And I was like, there's no way he's going to get that shirt. And obviously, whereas I knew how to talk. I'm like, okay, tuck in. This shoulder. He listened to everything I said, but I made sure we're nice and tight.
Mm-hmm.
And the wingers couldn't go forward.
Yeah.
So I'm like, there ain't no way these lot are scoring. So it's almost like two wingers, fullbacks. I got six defenders, basically.
Yeah. But you're playing like a pro.
So I didn't know this.
Yeah.
So I didn't know this stuff. So I'm thinking, right, hold on a minute. Like, just be aggressive, man.
Mm-hmm.
I almost got sent off because I bit the striker. Like, I was pulling his shirt.
You bit him, bro?
I bit him in the air, man. The corners. I just grab him and just bite his ear.
I mean, you're the first Luis Suarez. Why are you biting people, bro?
Let me say that in a better way. Yeah.
No, you said it. It's out there now. You can't bring it back. You can't pull it back.
I was hungry, man. I needed it.
Yeah, it was after heartbreak.
I needed it. That's what I was thinking in the whole game. I needed it.
I get it.
Like, you have to get bitten, so out of the 50 players, Trey, I was the only one that got picked back.
Listen,
so it must have worked, man.
So to any kids listening, just bite people, you'll be alright.
No, don't bite people.
So I'd been given a 2-year scholarship at Crystal Palace off the back of a successful trial. That would have meant I would have been on my journey to becoming a professional football player. I knew Andy would have been so proud of me. All those years of hard work and him taking me into his home from 10 years old were a reflection of where I was at that moment in that time.
When I heard that you had gone into Crystal Palace and signed as a professional, I have to say, it was like a feather in my cap because you're my player. Mm. That's why you're at Palace. So it was a bit... And you was my first player to sign for a professional team.
I was like, why is Bob... Why me type of thing, you know? What did you see in me that you probably thought something stood out?
Yeah, I saw raw talent.
This is Bob Dowie. He was director of football at Crystal Palace.
Saw, like, when you stayed in the game, great size, great pace, you know, on the turn. Little bit of hunger, little bit of rawness there. Yeah. Something... What I loved about you on the pitch is you had two personalities. You had a lovely, easygoing personality off the pitch. Then when you stepped on it, you were like an intense competitor and you were no longer this lovely, cuddly lad. You were now like a proper defender, somebody who wanted to get wired in, somebody that was going to have a personal battle with someone and try and come out on top always. And I loved that about you, you know. So that's what I saw in you, really. It was a good group, your group you were in, you know, with some good lads that went on to have decent careers, and you were the best of all of them. But you weren't the best of all of them just because of football. Mm. It was you as well everybody loved. They loved your humility. You were just humble. You were a great guy. Everybody loved you.
So the end of my scholarship, my manager at the time said, Moses, have you got a suit? I'm like, where am I going to get a suit? So I asked my mum, she gave me the money. I'm like, why do I wear a suit? But I didn't know I was going to win an award. So my two teammates, Victor Moses was wanted by every club in the country. Johnny Bostock was wanted by every club in the world. We went into the stadium, the whole club, directors, chairman, that I remember them saying, young player of the year, or scholarship of the year, Moses Swaben. I was like, I literally rocked back and forward and I was like, they're on me. They're like, yeah, Moses, you've won. It's like, won what? They're like, yeah, you won young scholar of the year. I was like, me? How about Victor? And they're like, go up there. So I've gone up there and I'm like, I've got the picture at home, but my face just tells it all what I was going through at that time. And I'm like, holding a trophy. Then 2 seconds later, they're like, yeah, Vice President's Young Player of the Year, Moses Swaben. I'm like, nah, come on, man, stop playing with me. Like, stop joking around. I remember the chairman at the time came up to my mum and she was like, we've really got big plans for Moses.
That was the end of the 2006-2007 season. I'd finished my scholarship and now I had my sights set on the first team.
Where are we?
So we're at the best stadium in the whole of Southeast London / the world, Crystal Palace, Selhurst Park. This was the first time I've ever gone and watched a live football game, Palace versus Manchester United. I remember walking up to the Holmesdale stand and actually looking down and thinking, hold on a minute, is that Ronaldo? Is that Roy Keane? Clinton Morrison? And literally all of the fans are just shouting and screaming. Little did I know, in many months to come, I'll actually be on that pitch with Swaby at the back of my shirt, number 41, walking out of that pitch, go and show everyone what you're made of. I remember putting my hands in my head, taking a deep breath, and just saying, you know what, this is the moment I've worked hard for. So much has happened in my life. Please, God, protect me in this game. The emotions were running high and that adrenaline was pumping, and I think it's so surreal because you can never get that back. And I think for every professional football player especially, that moment you make your debut is like a fine line of like literally life and death. So I can almost imagine a surgeon, it going beep, 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 when it goes flatline, that's when you're ready to go out. So Palace actually had a, I don't know whether they still have it, but every time before a game you hear an alarm bell. When that alarm bell comes on and you hear the fans swinging and screaming, and you're walking out to that pitch, I remember looking over at my family and I'm like, damn. It was only a few years I was getting grounded for 6 weeks, going to Andy's house with the grass all the way up until my knees, going to Crystal Palace training ground, training with the first team, to now I'm actually on this pitch with people that I've looked at on Match of the Day telling me, Moses, you're going to be all right.
In that game, though, my fitness levels just weren't there. I struggled. But Bob Dowie said to me, oh, don't worry about today. We're very fond of you. But in football, things change all the time, including management.
Staying with football, Neil Warnock is the new manager of Crystal Palace. He replaces Peter Taylor, who was sacked on Monday.
So, following on, travelled the pre-season with the team, but then Neil Warnock's come in. And he was like, you're not ready. You need to go into non-league.
Why, in your opinion, didn't that work out for you?
I think in an honest way, I weighed 70 kg as a centre-half.
Palace. Are you getting bullied?
Yeah, exactly. So, obviously, throughout my time at Palace, Troy, I had to study the game. So, whereas I weren't technically...
playing catch-up.
But then, Neil Warnock didn't give me an excuse and he was like, you're not ready.
You have to appreciate the honesty, yeah.
Oh, I was just desperately sad when I heard you'd got released.
This is Bob Dowie again.
Because you should have been a Premier League footballer, without a shadow of a doubt. You know, you really should. I was so disappointed because, you know, from a very early time saw something in you. We didn't get to develop you. Mm. I just felt very sad that you'd gone because I know how much it meant to you and I know it was the biggest thing in your life.
Yeah.
And I just felt that, you know, rightly or wrongly, and we'll never know this, but I thought we'd definitely seen a different Moses Swaben.
when I got released, I wasn't even upset, Trey. I'll be honest, man. I knew it was coming.
Yeah, but I'm trying to think why it didn't not hurt. That's the wrong part, because I clearly would have hurt. But why was it okay that you got let go?
In training, I really struggled with putting on weight. When we actually played training games, I was out my depth physically, and I just felt I weren't ready. I learned so much at Crystal Palace, but I actually embraced leaving the club. I needed to go somewhere else to keep getting matches and use it as a stepping stone to get back up to a bigger club. So then I asked myself, who's my local team? Bromley in the Conference South. At the time, Mark Goldberg was the manager.
How did you get on with Mark?
The beginning of our relationship, he gave me the platform to go and play football again and enjoy it.
Nice.
Played there for 3 games and I was just really confident.
Mm-hmm.
Then after 5 games, I had a friend called Marcus, and I was like, Marcus, I ain't got an agent, yeah? I didn't even know what agent was, but I was like, do me a favour. I've got a list of every League 1 and League 2 club. Championship's too high, but can you call every club and ask them for a trial? He's calling. League 2 club. Lincoln got back and said, yeah, can you come up to Lincoln for a trial game? So went up on a Tuesday in the evening, training on Thursday, played a game against Walsall. Then that's how I left Bromley and went to Lincoln. It came at the perfect time for me because I felt in my career, I need to leave London, man. My friend's recently been stabbed. He's been killed. People are going to jail. I've moved from Croydon to...
Wait.
Yeah.
I'm just going to jump past that.
Yeah, one of my friends got stabbed before a game. So he was stabbed in Croydon. Obviously, this was probably my first death.
Yeah.
And again, it's that, who'd you speak to? You try and football allowed me to block it out, but it just painted over a lot of cracks. I was like, you know what? I need to leave, man.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just go somewhere where I can focus. And I actually embraced moving away. Yeah, so Lincoln City was miles away up north, far away from London. They were in League Two at the time, and I saw the club as my second chance to start again. So when I joined in early 2009, the manager was Peter Jackson and his assistant was Ify Onora. Weren't until my first kind of day there.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, this is long.
this is in the middle of nowhere.
This is in the middle of nowhere, but you have to remember, I'm going into training.
Mm.
We didn't really have a lot of black players at that time.
Yeah.
So then, when you're good in training, people respect you.
Of course they do, yeah.
The captain, Scott Kerr, he was like, oh, you're doing really well, lad. You know, the manager likes you. Peter Jackson's from Bradford. But we had Ify Onora. So Ify was my assistant.
That's my guy, Ify.
Ify was the first kind of manager I had that actually used to sit me down. Ify will give me lessons on culture and how important it is for us or people of colour or black people to be able to come into these environments and really, really show both on and off the pitch who you are.
Yeah.
I remember saying to Ify, I want to be captain. This is what I said to him on trial. That was my thing. I want to be captain. And he was he kind of knocked me down a peg. He was like, see how your reserve game go first.
Mm-hmm.
Played another reserve game, man of the match. The gaffer was like, yeah, well, I want you on the bench for Rochdale.
You're on trial for 7 days.
Yeah. Then he's like, yeah, I think you can sign you. Then the gaffer was like, we're going to put you up in a nice little apartment in Lincoln. I was like, okay. Then he's like, yeah, we'll look after you. I'm going to sign you for 6 months. So signed on £350, most money I've made.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was like, damn, that's a lot of money, man.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'd only been at Lincoln for about 8 months when the gaffer, Peter Jackson, got the chop.
Former Blackburn and Celtic striker Chris Sutton has been named as the new manager of Lincoln City, replacing Peter Jackson, who was sacked earlier this month.
Chris Sutton and Ian, they took the level here.
Okay, is the real deal.
This is the real deal.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously from then, there's certain things you can and can't get away with.
Mm-hmm.
You know who ain't putting it in training.
Yeah.
You know who's can't be bothered or ain't on the team. But when they came in, they changed the whole dynamic of how we played, things like what you eat, time. I was like, right, this is crazy.
And timings,
with the gaffer back there.
Chips are off the menu.
Yeah, man. And I got the captain's armband in and around that time.
There's a name that keeps popping up, and I know of him as well, Delroy Facey.
Delroy was a big deal.
He'd played in a Premier League at Bolton and he'd even had some international football experience. When he came to Lincoln City, it was obvious he was a marquee signing.
He changed the whole dynamic of that change room.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, like, when I first met him, I was like...
He's the light, you're the moth. Like, yeah, like, you have to go to...
He shook my hand, I was like, rah. I almost broke my fingers, you know. But then Daryl was like, he grouped everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So whereas I was like, I had aspirations of being the captain, I remember, like, and this is what football teaches you, like, mm-hmm. don't be too high, don't be too low. So I was like, you know what, let me keep my thoughts in my head before they come out. So
yeah.
Daryl was like, hey, you know what, I heard about you. And I was like, what did you hear? He's like, yeah, man, like, trust me, we're going places. Then we just created, like, Daryl was probably my best friend
okay.
in that team because of our characters kind of matched. Mm-hmm. I was ready to ride for him. So at Lincoln, there were different groups. Mine, I suppose, were the London boys. And Del did become part of that. We liked him and we respected him. But then there were things happening around him that seemed a bit strange, like people were turning up to the training ground, wanting to know where he was. And there was another thing too. Dore would go around asking players for loans. We've got open training ground. Daryl would be like, oh, like, oh, like, lend me £30, man. I'll give it back to you tomorrow. I just got to put petrol in my car. Then someone will give him the money. Then someone will come to the training ground. Like, oh, have you seen Daryl? And I'm like, this feels like the ends.
Yeah.
So I'm like, why is this kind of happening type of thing? But I never paid no mind to it.
So League Two, we've got a midweek game, Northampton away. We stop off at the hotel and we all check in as usual. Boys are all having a bit of banter. I used to always room with the same teammate. Usually those evenings drag. You're pumped up about the game the following day. But then you've got nervous energy and there's actually nothing you can do about it.
Then, probably around just before our curfew, doors rang.
Yeah, you man.
It's exactly how I said it.
You man, come down to my room.
So obviously we're thinking, it happens all the time.
Football stuff.
You know, football stuff. No one don't really want to go to bed at that time. People can't sleep, insomnia. So we've gone down to Del's room. Then as we go down to his room, there's a white guy standing up, tall, like well built. Del is sitting on the bed and like, we're kind of sitting like teenagers
mm-hmm.
on the side of the bed, looking at each other like, what's going on? Then Del's like, opened the duffel bag. It was like 60K in euros. So I remember at that moment, I'm thinking, what the hell's going on? 60,000 euros. If we lose tomorrow, we can split it.
What score? Were they asking for like a 2-0?
It wasn't even like...
0-0.
It was like a 1-0... It was like a one goal deficit before the first half. I'm thinking, what the fuck? What's this?
Yeah.
So I'm thinking to myself, I looked... Remember, one of my friends is from Peckham, so he's from the ends. And the other guy lives on Old Kent Road. So... We're looking at each other like, rah. And Del's like, oh, like, this was normal. In my eye line, I'm looking at this guy, and the guy just looked like... I'll give you an example. The guy looked like something stereotypical you see in a film.
Yeah.
That's the best way I can describe it. So
somebody you just don't want to mess with.
He's like a scary Russian bad guy from a film.
He's like, yeah, don't worry, no pressure. You know, if you guys get the score right tomorrow, everybody's happy and... You know, you can go away. Does anyone want to take it? Sleep with it and let me know how you feel. Who wants to sleep with the money? Next time on Confessions of a Match Fixer. My teammates come up to me and like, oh, Moses, like, you know there's these guys that fix matches. Do you want to come to this meeting tomorrow? But we need five. There's you. Who are going to be the other three?
Mm-hmm. Can I make a statement?
Yeah, go on.
The vulnerable ones.
On BBC Sounds, this is Sport's Strangest Crimes. from the man who tried to buy cricket.
One night, one game, winner take all, $20 million.
The kidnap of a super horse.
It must have been terrifying.
Of course it was. How we got through all
that. An ill-advised errand changing F1 forever.
It will haunt the people involved for as long as they live.
A $1 trillion takeover which never took off.
Fraudsters of this level, they will never stop.
The mysterious death of a superstar cyclist.
Entering the world of professional cycling was like joining the mafia.
And teammates becoming bitter enemies at one of the biggest football clubs in the world.
Betrayal, plot. We've gone beyond women's football in France.
Sport's strangest crimes. Listen on BBC Sounds.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
The following podcast contains some strong language.
All right, cool. We ready to go, peeps? I kind of got to tee it up as well, so.
Previously on Confessions of a Match Fixer, all I ever wanted to do was go to school, be happy and be free. When I went into football, you can't take drugs, you can't smoke, you can't take alcohol.
When I heard that you had gone into Crystal Palace, it was like a feather in my cap because you're my player.
This is the moment I've worked hard for. So much has happened in my life. Please, God, protect me in this game.
There's a name that keeps popping up, and I know of him as well. Dalroy Facey.
Mm. We're kind of sitting like teenagers on the side of the bed looking at each other like, what's going on? Then Del was like, yeah. Opened a duffel bag, it was like 60k in euros. So I remember at that moment, I'm thinking, what the hell's going on?
$60k, it's right in front of you.
I'm looking at this guy and he's like, who wants to sleep with the money? I've never seen that type of money in my life, let alone in that moment. So a few things crossed my mind. I was thinking, like, what's happening in football?
Yeah. Or, is this everywhere?
Like,
yeah.
Does the gaffer know?
Mm.
Or more importantly, like, has the gaffer given money to Dory? Like, is this a joke? And then one of the boys was like, oh, yeah, I'll take it and sleep with the money. I'm thinking, what the hell? He went staying in my room, but whilst me and my friend have got back to the room, I was like, right, should we check on Del and make sure Del's okay? So a lot of these things crossed my mind. Then the following morning, we go for our team walk. Then we get on a coach. Everyone's gone to the back of the coach where he used to play cards and things. And Del's like, yeah, you know, the money's on the coach in the bag. Then I'm like, bro, you can't leave it there. What happens if someone loses that money?
Mm-hmm.
That's the first thing I thought. Forget the money. What happens if that money goes missing? When we got off the coach going into the change room, hour before kickoff. So Northampton away, 60 grand in the change room, and there's four of us that know what can happen. A one goal deficit before the first half. Then Del's in the change room with the money, in the actual change room.
Man.
And like, there's a vivid picture, but then he needed to notify the guy, are they in or they're out?
Fixing investigator has highlighted suspicious betting patterns.
Admitted or been found guilty of fixing games.
Among those arrested are several football players.
I'm Moses Swebu, and this is Confessions of a Match Fixer, Episode 2, By Any Means Necessary. Was this the time? Was it right? My first manager, Andy Brogan, always said, if you do the right thing, you're going to go football. This didn't seem like the right thing. Going 1-0 down before halftime. I was like, yeah, nah.
This ain't the time.
This ain't the time. Hell no, we ain't doing that. And it turned out, us players, the ones Delroy brought to the meeting with the Russian match fixer, were all on the bench anyway. So maybe Del didn't do the best job of setting up the fix.
Was there, just in hindsight, was there a moment where you thought, what if?
Yeah, 100%. So it crossed my mind and I was like, nah, man, there's too much to lose because in football, when you're flying, you're here. You don't think about anything else. Football can very much seem like it isn't a career because you're just used to, I just want to play football, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah,
not
yeah.
once did I ever think, Troy, I want to earn X amount of money. Like, I didn't have an agent. I didn't go into contracts and think, oh,
let me get X amount and X amount. I was just like, I just want to play football. So money wasn't really an option in my head that would have swayed me to saying yes at that time.
Let's get all the classified football results now with James Alexander Gordon.
League 1, Northampton Town 2, Lincoln City 1.
So when we got back on the coach, Dell's taken the money. So the following morning, Dell's like, yeah, come, let's go. Give the guy back the money. So he didn't need all of us, but we're all there. So I'm thinking, why do you need everyone to be there? So I don't know whether the guy may have said to him, make sure those players come back because I want to know that
everyone's on board.
Everyone's on board, type of thing. Yeah. So Dell took the duffel bag out of the car, gave it back to him, and that was the last time I'd ever heard Dell Ray speak about match fixing again. Until the morning we were travelling down to the away game, he's pulled me specifically. He's like, oh, Mo, you know what? Don't say nothing about what happened the other day, yeah? So, yeah, no, you're good, man.
I'm going to say something. You might be a little bit insensitive, but I'm going to say it anyway because it's me. But it feels like he's grooming you. Like, not in a sexual way, but like in the way of like, I've dropped this in.
Mm.
I know this is going to, it's there, but now I've got to protect myself. So let me big brother him. Let me act like I'm helping, but really it's one arm here.
Yeah.
The other arm's like, yo, do you still, this is still there though. Do you know what I mean? Like he's got his arm around you, but he's feeding you food that he knows is poisonous.
You know, I agree with you though, Trey. It's almost
sorry like, for the word grooming, no, but I just think
it's the correct term because when you really look deep into it, that's what the streets do. And when you're coming from our communities, if someone's helped you out, you ain't going to turn around and snitch on your brother or snitch on a teammate or say something.
Although my time at Lincoln has started really well, just like at Palace, a change of management changed everything.
Just a year after taking the job, Chris Sutton has quit as manager of League Two side Lincoln City. The former Blackburn and Chelsea striker cited personal reasons for his decision to leave. The Imps currently sit 20th in the table, having picked up just 2 wins from 9 games.
Ian and Chris had left at that time.
And then who comes in after him?
Steve Tilson comes in.
Lincoln City have named the former Southend boss Steve Tilson as their new manager. He's agreed a 2.5-year deal.
Yeah.
So you and Steve Tilson didn't get on that well, right?
No. Terrible relationship.
It's no wins in 4 in all competitions now for Lincoln, who seem to have fallen flat again following the arrival of new manager Steve Tilson.
You know, he turned around and told me to train with the youth team. I think I'd played like 70 games at the time. Like the majority, 65 or probably starts as well.
Yeah.
I always thought to myself, if I can give myself till like 24 and kind of build up through the leagues, League One, Championship, hopefully Premier League one day, like I saw that in my future. But when a club were like, yeah, we want to let you go, and like, what is that? I'm training with a youth team. New players are coming. They're probably thinking,
who's this?
Who the fuck? Yeah. Man, this guy's shit. Then I was like, yeah, man, I got to leave this place.
So I called a gaffer, Mark Goldberg. He'd been good to me when I was at Bromley before. But Bromley was in the Conference South. I knew I was taking a big step down again.
So you got to Bromley for the second time under the same manager, under Mark.
Yeah.
And now you get signing on fee and all of that. Can you just explain, like,
yeah, it was quite,
how that happened, really?
Yeah, it was quite rare at that time for that level for players to get signing on fees, especially whereas Bromley were part time.
Yeah.
So when I re-signed for them, Bromley were not a full time team.
Go on.
Which literally
you
means,
can tell me now. Well, yeah, how much you get?
So signed on like £800 a week with like 150 bonus, half check, half cash, and £10,000 signing on fee.
Huh?
So when I left Lincoln, I got
wait. I got to interrupt. You know how much I got for signing on at Watford?
This was in, remember, Mark's a businessman.
Okay.
This same time.
Yeah. So I signed for Watford the year before in the Championship. I got 25K.
Yeah. It's a lot of money, though. Yeah.
What do you mean? I'm in the Championship. You're in Bromley. So you mentioned, obviously, Mark there helping you out and being a businessman. Yeah.
that relationship stemmed from the first time, but how close really were you guys?
And I'll say, like, I was really close. Yeah. Mark's probably, if I was to look at all the managers I've had, Mark was the closest thing to home, I felt like.
Okay.
When I signed, re-signed, he kind of gave me a vision, and I'm like, you know what, I'm still 24. And even though I've played a lot of games, Troy, I can potentially go back into the league. I can stay here and build with Bromley.
I'm hearing that you were picking the team with the gaffer.
Yeah. So we used to...
Did that happen?
So when I first signed...
We need to go to... You and I got a different relationship.
Yeah.
Because if you're picking the team, it's sort of like a nice
little... Pick the team with him though, by the way.
Right, but you're picking the team.
Yeah.
Because he's asking you, so you're giving the influence. Yeah. You get 10 bags signing on fee. Mm. You're basically, at this point, you're a championship player. Essentially.
Well, you told me. Yeah.
Mate, you are.
Mark gave me the influence because maybe in his eyes, this is my opinion.
Yeah.
He kind of saw me as a son.
Okay.
He's given me that confidence to really go ham, if that makes sense. Go and take ownership of everything on the pitch. So I orchestrated how that change room environment was. Remember, we're only training twice a week, so I created a car school for all the boys that come into London, and we're all driving to training together. After games, we'll stay behind, talk about the game, whether we lose, win or draw, and just create like a family environment. And obviously, Mark loved that.
Yeah.
So it took away his actual job because he wasn't very good at like communicating football to the players because he's not a football person. And whilst I created that environment, that quickly changed.
We went on a losing streak and Mark wasn't really a man manager, so he got emotional. Our relationship deteriorated. We argued about the team and where it was all going. And this is significant because my girlfriend's pregnant at the time. So whereas before, money and security didn't mean so much to me, it was different now.
You know, so I feel I'm losing my edge in training and in games. And maybe part of it is I need time off because I'm having a daughter. But a big part of it is, in my mind, I'm thinking, you know what? Most important thing right now in my life is making sure from a financial position, I need to pay for everything that I'm being put under pressure on by the missus.
Yeah, absolutely.
And like, she don't understand football. So I'm almost trying to accelerate my journey into manhood 5 years ahead of what it needs to be done. Because I'm very much...
I get that. And I think as well, what people need to understand is, as footballers, we are the most selfish people ever. If you ask my oldest son, who's 15 next week, he's probably had five days with me, one-on-one. 5 days, max. Mm. But I was always, and probably you're in a similar situation, I'm providing. So you get one or the other.
Mm.
You can't have both.
Yeah.
And I think that's where you're kind of... I have to provide because I'm probably not going to be there as much with the football. Do you get what I mean?
And like when I'm having those thoughts, I'm thinking like, what's the one thing I've always missed, man? I can't allow my daughter to come into life in minus.
Ooh.
So my daughter can't come into this world whilst I'm on the back foot.
Why have a daughter then?
So this is a thing. If I'm going to be brutally honest with you,
sorry, I'm just
no.
Talking
it's a good point you made because I was never expecting to be in that position. So up until that point, I was still trying to figure it out. So I had this perfect version in my head, Troy. I'm like, I'm with my childhood sweetheart. We've planned for my daughter. Everything up until that point was me going and.
Having a trajectory.
So just because of who I am, I know there's always an opportunity.
I'm with you as well because I think this is where we'll start to like that clash. But our approach to those situations are so different. So when I had my son at 20, I was fucked. I had no money. I was still living with my mom. I had no car. I've gone, fuck, I need to make this happen, in my opinion. And I think the way I did it, not trying to go wild and joy, fucking hell, by no stretch of imagination, is what 90% of people listening to this will go, well, yeah, I've got problems. I didn't plan to have my son or daughter, but we figured it out. But you took a different route.
Yeah, so I remember the training session, we're doing our jog around the pitch, and my teammates come up to me, he's like, oh, Moses, like, what are you doing tomorrow? I'm like, no, nothing. Why, what's going on? He's like, oh, you want to come to a meeting after training? Then he says it to me in a way like, you know, there's these guys that fix matches.
Yeah.
I didn't say nothing. Continue jogging around. Mm. I knew there may be 60 bags at the end of that conversation. And I was like, you know what? Talk to me about it tomorrow. So the following day, when I spoke to him, he was like, we need 5. That's exactly how he said it. We need 5. The first thing I said to myself was, there's me, there's you. Who are going to be the other 3? You're not going to go to your captain or the goalkeeper or someone that's actually going to go and tell somebody. You're going to go to somebody that you can, like, well, one of the boys. But then even
can
with
that... Can I make a statement?
You know?
The vulnerable ones.
100%. I'd already strategized in my mind how a pitch will work and look like from the people that I can approach. I remember I've got the influence on the team.
Mm-hmm.
So I know if you're a winger and you're doing stepovers and doing your thing in training, I know if you can't do that on a Saturday, there's something up here that ain't clicking.
Yeah.
So he may be able to do it, but he ain't got the right mentality.
I've put here, no jot, I showed a piece of paper for people that can't see. Because I'm a people person. So I've put strategizes. This is me looking at you. You strategize, know people really well. You have a small circle, needs to look after them. Organized leader and a delegator.
It's crazy, man.
Some David Blaine shit I just did there.
Yeah, man. That's what? Those are the...
Well, you knew, like...
Yeah, I knew.
You knew who you were picking and...
I knew. You mentioned a good thing. When I'm having the Delra experience, where it's like, you don't realise you're being groomed.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you're being groomed, you become the groomer.
With my understanding of Delra, I don't know him personally, never met the man, but I know people around him and who have. He is orchestrator and leader and... enforcer of what he wants to happen. I feel like the guy who came to you tried to be that, and I don't even know where the rest of the story is going.
Yeah, man.
But I know you, and I could already understand. You've gone, no problem, I'll take that off you, and now you've become Dara.
It was like you were there. You got it.
Yeah, so
yeah, you got
it. I understand people quite well.
You got it straight away. I'm like, going into that meeting, I'm going to be honest with you, Troy, there was nothing that could have got in the way. I didn't know what was at the end of that. I didn't know we were going to get money.
Yeah.
I just knew going into that meeting, there may be 60 grand that I'm willing to take by any means necessary.
So with that then, talk us through it. Tell me about this meeting.
We're driving to the Mayfair Hotel.
What we're talking, 2011,
2012.
For the people that don't know, Mayfair, that was the spot.
That was the spot.
The bar in there was going off.
That's exactly where we had the meeting, sidebar at the back. I remember walking into the Mayfair Hotel and I had an old fashioned.
Good time. Good time.
Old fashioned.
Classy drink.
Old fashioned. We probably waited like half an hour. I could tell my teammates were nervous, but I'd seen another player from another team. But he was older, he just retired. I didn't know him, and I'm thinking, well, why is he here? So he's like, yeah, would you not think about the game tomorrow? I was like, to be fair, I know the striker. He should be playing in the Football League. He's like, all right, cool, save it for the meeting. That's exactly how he said it. So he was like, finish your drinks.
Then I get this. Was he the conduit then? So he was the guy kind of
sees. He, I already knew from body language and that he had much more experience in doing this than what I've seen before.
Yeah.
And
even more than Delroy at this point.
Yeah, even more than Delroy.
Okay.
Like, so he made us, or he made me, feel much more confident going into that meeting because he was calm. Like, he weren't panicking.
Emotionless, yeah.
So my experience with people that are really calm, there's a tone that's set in that space that allows someone like myself in that time to be like, oh, right, this is cool, man. Let's go upstairs and see what's happening. So we've clicked on the lift. All of us have rammed into
into a conference room.
Or no, it was an actual hotel room,
Doors opening. Going up.
the room that we went into was at the other end of the corridor. And from what I remember, I just remember that colour red in like a really royal type of colour. So you actually smell the essence of something that smells expensive. And before you even go in there, you're feeling like taking in a breath and breathing out, and you're like, damn, this environment ain't like how outside is or where we're coming from or those communities, because psychologically you're kind of almost, I wonder what's around the corner, what's going to happen. And it was almost like walking into a film set because it felt very staged. When we went into the room, I remember opening the door first. No word of a lie, Trey, this guy's like 5 foot, standing up, thinking, what the fuck? He sat down on the bed, turned his back to us.
He's the governor.
Yeah, turned his back, started doing something on his laptop, but he's smoking. So I'm thinking, bro, you can't smoke in this hotel.
He's the man in charge. He spins his back because he's like,
main guy.
I just wanted to know who's in, how many, cool.
But then it's crazy because he didn't know English.
Oh, okay.
So as he turns his back and he's speaking his native language, it's being translated to us. He's sitting with his back to us, watching the TV, flicking his cigarettes, lighting up another one, flicking his cigarettes.
Oh, okay.
Translator's standing up. This guy's probably around 20, slim, glasses. He's like, oh, do you not want to drink? He was like, oh, no, we had some drink downstairs. And he's like, yeah, got straight to the point. The translator was very specific with what he wanted.
Specific,
we need you guys to lose 2-0 in the first half only. So however those goals come, it can come in the 5, 10, 15, 20, 25.
Yeah.
Just make sure it's 2-0 in the first half. After that, go and play normal. Whilst we were given instructions, he gave us a bag. And remember at that time, we were already getting brown paper bags from Bromley on our wages.
It was a normal thing too.
It was a normal thing. Mm-hmm. You know, half check, half cash. We used to banter who's getting more, whose one's light. But this time, I felt the weight. And I was like, shit, this is a couple grand in here, you know. Mm-hmm. The translator translated, keep the money.
Yeah.
If you don't want to fix the game,
keep
the money. Thank you for coming to the meeting.
Yeah, just like, basically giving you like a little retainer. Like, here's a five if you get involved.
So everyone took the bag and it was like, look, tomorrow, let us know whether you guys want to do it.
Question though, about teammates, were they scared?
Yeah, man, scared.
And then what was the chat with them?
First thing they said, who the fuck's that? The first thing they said was like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
They've got the money in their hands.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like you can go back upstairs and say, here, take it back.
We get in the car. Yeah. You're set, you know, I'm in. Person A, who's in the car with you, are you like, is he asking lots of questions? Are you like, yo, I'm doing this and trying to, your confidence makes him come in like, yeah, you're on it, so I'm on it.
It was more so, what do I think they're going to decide?
Okay, so you two were chatting really about, you're in car A, you're chatting about car B.
In my mind, the first thing I said to myself, Trey, was, how do you figure this stuff out on your own?
Ooh.
So I knew in that meeting with those specific instructions, it made me think, and I was like, you know what? You can actually do this on your own. Or I think I can do it on my own.
Yeah.
I knew my teammates were very hesitant, even if they said yes.
Mm-hmm.
One of them probably ain't gonna do nothing. Three of them are surprised.
Yeah.
So leading up into that game, I was like, I'm doing it. Next time on Confessions of a Match Fixer. I'm driving my automatic car with one leg and I'm like shifting all the cash over and like pushing the, and it's probably like 100 grand.
If you get pulled with cash now.
Yeah. Game over.
You've been listening to Sport's Strangest Crimes on BBC Radio 5 Live. You can catch up with the full series now. Just search Confessions of a Match Fixer on BBC Sounds.
Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at 1 o'clock. This is Anna Cunningham. The British boxer Daniel Dubois has retained his IBF world heavyweight title with a fifth round knockout of two-time former unified heavyweight champion Anthony Joshua. 96,000 people watched the fight at Wembley Stadium, where Oasis's Liam Gallagher fired up the crowd playing three songs. Dubois dominated the bout, dropping Joshua multiple times. Speaking after the fight, he thanked his supporters.
It's been a long journey. I'm grateful to be in this position. God bless. I'm a gladiator, I'm just a warrior to the end, to the bitter end, and I'm just ready to go. You know, I want to go to the top level of this game and reach my full potential. You know, behind the scenes, to work with my dad, all my family and, my strong team here, they've helped me get through this. So God bless you all, man.
Israel has restricted gatherings from the northern city of Haifa up to the border with Lebanon. It said it was in anticipation of retaliatory strikes by Hezbollah. Earlier, dozens of Israeli warplanes carried out more widespread airstrikes on targets in southern Lebanon. The US National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan warned of the possibility of igniting a regional war. Najat Saliba, a member of the Lebanese parliament in Beirut, says many are fearful of a wider war.
People are hearing the strikes, over 100 strikes that were launched from Israel. We are seeing also pictures of fires and bombs everywhere. People are worried about a full-scale war or a larger scope of war, which is really something that most people don't want to see in Lebanon.
Fresh allegations have been made about the late former Harrods boss, the billionaire Mohammed Al-Fayed. Lawyers representing women who say they were raped or sexually assaulted by him say they've received 150 new inquiries since a BBC documentary revealed allegations against him. Our reporter Ellie Price is following the latest.
A number of the abuse has been detailed as happening in properties in Paris. There's also victims who've come forward from the US, from Dubai, from